the 26th anniversary of John Lennon's death, I'm here with David Leith, writer, producer and director of the film John Lennon vs. the US. David, could you explain what the film is about?
Very simply, the film is the story of what happens when John and Yoko embark on their campaign for peace and essentially get caught in the crosshairs of the Nixon administration, because all the president's men and J. Edgar Hoover, who's the head of the FBI, and Strom Thurmond from the U.S. Senate and Attorney General John Mitchell, are concerned that Lennon will pose a threat to Nixon's re-election in 1972. What they do is they attempt to deport him so that he won't be in the United States and won't go on a concert tour, which they're concerned will inspire a young electorate to come out and vote against Nixon. In 1972, it was the first year that 18-year-olds had the right to vote in America. And what that meant is somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 30 million first-time voters would be participating in the first presidential election. When you think about people, you know, 20, 21, 22, those were all people like myself who had fallen in love with the Beatles, you know, in 1964.
You've made many films about musical icons, cultural icons, Brian Wilson, Frank Sinatra, various others. Why did you want to make one about them?
The Beatles were they weren't just heroes, it was almost a religion. They were that important to us, not just musically, but socially and culturally. I went to school in Washington, D.C. during the Nixon administration. The campus at George Washington University was 5 blocks from the White House. It was called by some activists the most strategically located campus in the country, and it was used as a staging area for anti-war demonstrations. I used to say we got tear gassed whether we wanted to or not. And so it was a very contentious time. If we take my greatest youthful musical passion and the most, if you will, exciting activist times of my life, it's kind of a collision of those two things. And when we were able to read the FBI documents and understand the outline of the story of what the administration had done, it was clear that there was a great movie to be made there. From our point of view, the idea is to make films that we'd want to see ourselves. And this was a story that people had heard bits and pieces of, but nobody had ever really connected all the dots.
A story with a political message?
Well, I think our goal is for the audience to walk out of the film thinking, but not for us to tell them what to think. That said, it's awfully hard to watch this movie and see the archival footage and not say to yourself, I can't believe what I'm hearing. When Nixon talks about, I think the exact words are something like, as the South Vietnamese troops become more capable, the rate of American troops will increase, but I have not and do not intend to set a timetable for their withdrawal. When you hear a speech like that from more than 35 years ago, and it so clearly is echoed in what we've heard in recent years, it can't help but say something, and it's up to each person to draw their own conclusion about what that means.
Gore Vidal compares the Nixon administration to the Bush administration when he talks about the use of the terms unpatriotic to criticize anti-war protesters or for scaring people into accepting the inevitability or the necessity of war. How did you feel about that? History repeating itself, perhaps, as you're making the movie?
There's a reason that Gore Vidal is the one who makes the most pointed commentary in the film, in that is perhaps America's greatest novelist and perhaps America's greatest historian. There's really nobody better qualified to address these issues, and I think he does it in his typically brilliant way. I really love what he says about, you know, for the most part, wars that are fought aren't necessary. He says sometimes you need to fight wars. He's not saying war is always wrong. The clear intent of what he's saying is that the Vietnam War was wrong, and by extension, the war in Iraq.
There's a great quote. Lennon says, we're selling it like soap. You've got to sell and sell until the housewife thinks, oh, there's peace and there's war, two products. It seems to indicate that he's thinking of peace as merely a shift in thinking, that if we only demand it, we can have it like a bar of soap. What happens when, as perhaps in the case of John Lennon, that demand is rejected?
It's clear that when John and Yoko said war is over if you want it, they were putting the onus on each and every one of us, that it was our responsibility to stop war, that we should not look to leaders or rock gods or anybody else to change the world for us, that it was up to us to do it ourselves, which was a very different message than vote for me and I'll set you free. And I think what John says repeatedly in the film is he talks about how, I think he says, apathy is not the answer. Flower power didn't work, but okay, so we start again. He clearly rejects the idea that doing nothing is acceptable.
You see his warmth, his wit, but you don't see, or it's glossed over rather, the drug taking, the boozing, the lost weekend, all those aspects mm-hmm. to Lennon's character seem to be glossed over.
Well, the movie isn't a biography of John Lennon. It's not the John Lennon anthology. We only spend about 3 minutes on the Beatles. And certainly we know that the Beatles were a little bit more important in John's life than that. The elements of the story that are, of John's story that are included in the movie are the parts of his life that are directly relevant to the U.S. versus John Lennon. We really had to stay focused on that because the movie's an hour and 40, and there were big pieces of the story of the U.S. versus John Lennon we didn't even have time to deal with. Mm. For example, Yoko's daughter from her first marriage, Kyoko, had been kidnapped by her ex-husband and taken to the United States. And one of the reasons that John and Yoko came to the U.S. was to look for Kyoko. Well, that's a pretty important story point in why they were fighting to stay in America when the deportation happened. You know, in the editing room, that became a cul-de-sac. In talking about the lost weekend, we cut a short sequence about that, but it didn't seem relevant to this story. You know, the tabloid aspects of John's life, it's pretty well known. Election night 1972 is a good example. We see Nixon getting reelected by a landslide, and we hear from Yoko how unhappy she and John were about it. We had cut a short sequence about a party on election night where John was drunk and misbehaved badly, but it didn't help the movie. It just slowed things down. And at that point in the movie, we're kind of hurtling towards the case and its conclusion.
To return to why the FBI were essentially after Lennon begins, is suggested in the film, when he becomes involved with perhaps more militant aspects of the anti-war movement, and is suggested that perhaps he's used as a tool by those actors.
I think there's a lot of truth to it, except from the point of view that John was a pretty strong man, very determined, and you couldn't tell him what to do. There's no question that when he and Yoko appeared on the scene in the second half of 1971, that the anti-war movement in America had sort of run out of steam. And there's a lot of reasons for it which aren't particularly relevant for this conversation, but the radical movement saw John and Yoko as a way to revitalize itself, and so they did everything they could to enlist them in the cause. In the about, say, from August, September of 71 till election night in November of 72, John was very involved. He gave a lot of money to radical causes. He appeared at a lot of benefits for radical causes. He wrote songs about the radical movement, a whole album, in fact, sometime in New York City, is all about kind of a gazette of him commenting on everything that he was seeing and experiencing. He did that because it's what he wanted to do then, and then when he didn't want to do it anymore, he stopped. I think it frustrated the movement that they couldn't control him.
Perhaps it stopped because he was in fear of his life?
Well, Yoko certainly indicates in the film that they were afraid to go to the Republican National Convention in the summer of 72 because they had been warned that they would be shot. Whether they would have been or not, the fact that they were scared of it gives you an indication of the paranoia that was everywhere. When all of a sudden you go from being beloved pop star to picking up your phone and hearing that you're being tapped, being followed, knowing that people are spying upon you, and if you combine that with what was probably a lot of pot smoking, one of the Nixon administration officials says our assumption, and quote, he says, is, you know, that Lennon was whacked out of his mind all the time, stoned. Yeah. So yeah, we don't go into a lengthy dissertation on how much drugs he was using, but we hear that the assumption was he was stoned.
Do you think Lennon was just a dreamer?
I think he was an artist. You think about how he could summarize almost an entire philosophy in five words. All you need is love. Give peace a chance. Imagine. I mean, those are beautiful dreams. Maybe unattainable. Maybe extremely naive. But it's what he believed in. They've stood the test of time. I mean, all you need is love is now, you know, almost 40 years old. And no one's going to argue with the idea of it. No one's going to argue with the idea of Give Peace a Chance. Imagine is a polarizing song.
There are people to this day in the United States who look at it as a communist manifesto and who think that John was dangerous because of that song. He's dead 26 years, and people on the radical right are still demonizing him as an agent who wanted to destroy the American way of life. So the U.S. versus John Lennon is a battle that continues. There's a book out called Imagine a God-Blessed America, in which the author, who's chief lobbyist for a 16 million member organization, you know, sets up John Lennon and that song as almost the devil's instrument. You can call those people misguided or crazy or whatever you want to call them, but the fact that there are so many people who feel that way is indicative of the threat that John Lennon and his philosophy was perceived as and continues to be by a certain number of people.
David Leaf, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure. Thank you for your time.